All right, so get this. Today we're diving into something just for you, and it's a pretty fascinating topic. We're going to be exploring an academic lecture all about the Apocrypha. And you might be surprised to learn just how much it actually impacted the New Testament and early Christianity. This isn't just some, dry history lesson either. We're talking about how ideas travel through time and how even figures like Jesus might have been shaped by these writings that are often overlooked.
It really is fascinating stuff. A lot of people haven't even heard of the Apocrypha, but once you start digging into it, you find all these intriguing connections with the New Testament. It's like discovering a secret passageway to a deeper understanding of teachings we thought we knew.
So let's start with the basics then. For those who might not know, what exactly is the Apocrypha?
Well, think of it like a collection of Jewish texts that were written between the Old and New Testaments. It's this bridge between those two eras. It gives us a glimpse into the religious landscape that really influenced those early Christians.
Okay, so are we saying that the authors of the New Testament were, like, directly quoting from these apocryphal texts?
Not exactly. While there aren't any direct quotes, there are some really interesting similarities that scholars have been studying for centuries.
Okay, now this is where I get curious. How do we know if these similarities are more than just coincidence? How do we tell if there's a real connection there?
That's the big question. It's like detective work.
Yeah.
We have to consider whether the apocryphal text would have even been available to the New Testament author at the time, right? And then we have to look at whether the similarities are unique enough to suggest a real connection. And are there multiple points of connection to rule out just random chance? It's all about piecing together the puzzle of how these ideas might have traveled through time.
I love that. A historical detective story. So what's one example of an apocryphal text that might have influenced the New Testament?
One that comes to mind is Ben Sira. He was a Jewish teacher in Jerusalem around 200 BC. He wrote a book called Wisdom of Ben Sira, and he was a pretty big deal back then, a respected figure, and his writings were found in places like Qumran and Masada. Even later Jewish scholars quoted him, so you can see how his influence really lasted.
Wow. So could Jesus himself have been influenced by Ben Sira's teachings? I mean, that's a pretty bold thought.
It is bold, but think about it. Even as the Son of God Jesus still grew up immersed in Jewish tradition, he would have been exposed to all sorts of teachings.
Right. I mean, the Gospel of Luke even describes him debating with teachers in the temple when he was just a boy.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
It shows that he wasn't just passively absorbing information, he was actively engaging with it.
That's actually a huge contrast to some of those non-canonical Gospels that portray Jesus as already knowing everything from childhood, right?
Exactly. The canonical Gospels offer a much more human portrayal of Jesus. They allow for growth and learning within that Jewish context. So now I'm even more curious to dive into those parallels between Ben Sira and Jesus. What are some of the teachings that seem to echo each other?
One that really stands out is their emphasis on generosity. For Ben Sira, it's all about imitating God's character. He says, "Do not reject a suppliant in distress or turn your face away from the poor. Be a father to orphans. Be like a husband to their mother. You will then be like a son of the Most High, and he will love you more than your own mother does."
So he's linking generosity with becoming like a son of God. Then how does Jesus's teaching on generosity differ? Is there a more radical idea there?
You're picking up on a really key difference there. When Jesus talks about generosity in the Sermon on the Mount, he says, "Give to everyone who begs from you, and do not refuse anyone who wants to borrow from you. Love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be children of your Father in heaven." So it's not just about becoming like God. It's about reflecting the very heart of God, who loves and cares for everyone, even the unlovable.
That adds a whole other layer to what I thought I knew about those teachings. Like, Jesus takes that concept of generosity and infuses it with this radical unconditional love. Mm-hmm. What about forgiveness? That's a huge theme for Jesus, too.
Absolutely. And we see a similar idea in Ben Sira as well, where he talks about the importance of forgiving others as a way to receive God's forgiveness. He says, "Forgive your neighbor the wrong he has done, and then your sins will be pardoned when you pray. Does a person harbor anger against another person and yet seek healing from the Lord?" He's making us ask, can we really expect God's mercy if we're holding on to bitterness towards others?
Yeah, it's like holding on to those grudges is presumptuous. Like, we're saying we deserve God's forgiveness even though we're not willing to extend it ourselves.
Yeah.
It makes you think about all those times you struggled to forgive someone and whether those words from Ben Sira and later from Jesus really hit home.
You're bringing it into the present moment, which is so important because it shows how these ancient teachings are still relevant today. Mm-hmm. They challenge us to look at our own hearts and consider how we approach forgiveness, both giving it and receiving it.
Speaking of challenging our assumptions, Jesus' teaching on storing up treasures in heaven always seemed so radical to me. It's like he's saying material possessions mean nothing compared to eternal rewards. Did that idea just come out of nowhere, or is there something similar in Ben Sira's teachings?
Ben Sira does use a similar image, but with a slightly different focus. He writes, "Lose your silver for the sake of a brother or a friend, and do not let it rust under a stone and be lost. Lay up your treasure according to the commandments of the Most High, and it will profit you more than gold." So he's encouraging generosity, but the emphasis is still very much on those earthly rewards. How doing good can benefit you in this life.
So it's like Jesus takes that familiar metaphor of treasure and elevates it, shifting the focus from this temporary gain to a more spiritual understanding of true wealth.
Exactly. You're right on. It's a great example of how Jesus draws on existing wisdom, but then expands its meaning, takes it to this whole other level. It's not just about being a good person so you'll be rewarded in this life. It's about aligning your heart with God's priorities, recognizing that true treasure is found in eternal things.
I like that. What other surprising parallels do we see?
Well, both Ben Sira and Jesus warn against presuming on God's mercy. Ben Sira says, "Do not commit a sin twice. Do not say, 'He will consider the multitude of my gifts, and when I make an offering to the Most High God, he will accept it.'"
Right. It's like thinking you can just buy God off with good deeds or religious rituals.
Yeah.
Without genuine repentance.
Exactly. And Jesus makes this point so clear in the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector. The Pharisee boasts about his piety and all his religious observance, but the tax collector humbly pleads for mercy because he recognizes his sinfulness. It's a stark contrast, and Jesus makes it clear that outward actions mean nothing without a truly repentant heart.
You know, I've always found that parable a little confusing, but hearing it in light of Ben Sira's teaching makes it so much clearer. It's about the posture of our hearts, not just our actions.
That's a great insight. It shows the importance of context. When we understand the Jewish world that Jesus was engaging with, his teachings become even more nuanced and profound.
Okay, now I'm really curious about those invitations to discipleship.
Yeah.
Ben Sira was a teacher, and obviously Jesus was the teacher. Are there any similarities in how they invited people to follow them?
This is where things get really interesting. Both Ben Sira and Jesus use this imagery of a yoke to describe discipleship, but their invitations are different in a really key way. Ben Sira writes, "Draw near to me, you who are untaught, and lodge in my school. Put your neck under the yoke and let your souls receive instruction. It is to be found close by." So he's inviting people to come to a specific place, his school, and submit to his teaching.
So it's like a traditional educational setting. Come sit, learn.
Exactly. But when Jesus says, "Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light." He's offering something completely different.
It's not about a physical location. It's about a way of life, a journey of following him wherever he goes.
That's the key. It's a call to leave everything behind and join him on the road. To embrace a life of radical discipleship that goes beyond just traditional learning.
This is all so insightful. I'm starting to see how these texts from the Apocrypha can really shed light on the New Testament.
That's why studying the Apocrypha is so rewarding. It helps us see those hidden connections and appreciate the richness and complexity of early Christian thought.
So we've seen all these fascinating parallels between Ben Sira and Jesus, but I'm guessing they didn't agree on everything. Are there places where Jesus breaks from that mold and charts his own course?
Absolutely. While there's clear continuity, there are also those points of departure where Jesus challenges those traditional wisdom teachings and really shows his originality. He pushes the boundaries of what people expected.
Now, that sounds like a story I want to hear. Where do we see Jesus forging his own path and setting himself apart from figures like Ben Sira?
One of the biggest differences is in how Jesus approaches inclusivity. You remember how Ben Sira advised limiting generosity to the pious?
Yeah, he was all about helping those deemed worthy.
Well, Jesus kind of throws that whole idea out the window. His compassion extends to everyone in need. It reflects a God who loves unconditionally, not just those who meet certain criteria.
That's a huge shift. It really highlights how central that radical love and acceptance is to Jesus's message.
It really does. And it goes beyond just who he helps.
Yeah.
Remember how Ben Sira reinforced those traditional views about women and was pretty hostile towards the Samaritans?
Right. It was a very us versus them mentality.
Exactly. But Jesus actively challenges those social norms. He welcomes women into his inner circle, engages in theological discussions with them, even features Samaritans as positive examples in his parables.
It's like he's intentionally breaking down those barriers that people like Ben Sira had so carefully constructed.
Exactly. He reaches out to those who are marginalized and excluded, showing a love that transcends those social divisions. And that would have been really radical in his time.
It makes you wonder how people reacted to that. Did they embrace it or were they resistant to those changes?
Probably a mixed bag, right? Some people were likely drawn to that message of inclusivity, while others would have felt threatened by it. It challenged the status quo and forced them to confront their own prejudices.
Another thing that comes to mind is Jesus's teaching on marriage. I remember reading in the Gospels how he seemed to take a much stricter stance on divorce than what was common at the time. Did Ben Sira have anything to say about that?
He did. Ben Sira condoned divorce and disobedience, which was pretty much in line with the prevailing views back then. But Jesus takes a different approach. He elevates God's original design for marriage, emphasizing that it's meant to be a lifelong covenant, a sacred and permanent bond.
It's like he's redefining marriage altogether.
Exactly. He's not just echoing the conventional wisdom. He's reinterpreting it in light of his understanding of God's unwavering love and commitment. It's a reminder that while Jesus was rooted in his Jewish heritage, he wasn't afraid to challenge it and offer a new perspective.
This is also fascinating. We've seen how Ben Sira's writings illuminate those connections between Jesus and the Jewish tradition, but also how Jesus sometimes breaks the mold. It makes you wonder if other New Testament figures might have also been influenced by the Apocrypha.
They absolutely were. In fact, James, the brother of Jesus, echoes Ben Sira's wisdom when he talks about the power of speech.
Oh, yeah. I've always been struck by James's imagery of the tongue as a fire. It's such a powerful way to describe how our words can either build up or destroy.
It's a vivid metaphor, and it's one that Ben Sira uses as well. He asks, "Who has never sinned with the tongue?" and notes that the tongue has no power over the godly. They will not be burned in its flame. It's like he's saying the righteous will be protected from the harmful effects of words, but those who aren't careful with their speech can cause a lot of damage.
And James echoes that warning when he writes, "The tongue is a fire, a world of unrighteousness. It defiles the whole body, sets the course of one's life on fire, and is itself set on fire by hell." It's amazing how both of them use that same fiery image to convey the power of our words.
They both grapple with the duality of speech. The same mouth can produce blessing and cursing, and they urge their followers toward greater integrity in their words. It's a reminder that our words carry weight. They have the power to hurt, to heal, to inspire, and to destroy. We need to be mindful of how we use them.
It makes you think about all the ways we use language today. Social media, political discourse, even our everyday conversations. It can be a minefield out there.
It really can. And both Ben Sira and James tackled a really thorny theological question that's still relevant today, the source of temptation.
Ooh, that's a tough one. Do they see it as coming from God, or do they place the responsibility elsewhere?
Both of them firmly reject the idea that God is responsible for tempting people to sin. They put the responsibility squarely on human desires and choices.
Which makes sense if you believe in a God who is purely good. Why would a loving God intentionally lead people into sin?
Right. It's an important point because it affirms God's goodness and holiness while acknowledging that we have the free will to choose right or wrong.
So we've seen how Ben Sira's wisdom might have shaped both Jesus and James. Are there any other apocryphal texts that had a big impact on early Christian thought?
One that stands out is the Wisdom of Solomon. It's a later apocryphal text that reflects what scholars call Hellenistic Jewish thought. That just means it was written by Jews who were heavily influenced by Greek culture and philosophy.
So how does that connect to early Christianity?
Well, it gives us valuable insights into the world of Paul, who was a key figure in spreading Christianity beyond its Jewish roots. While Paul probably didn't directly quote from the Wisdom of Solomon, they both grappled with similar ideas and arguments, especially when it came to critiquing the beliefs and practices of non-Jews, the Gentiles.
Now that you mention it, I know Paul was pretty outspoken about his views on idolatry. He saw it as a major stumbling block for people coming to faith in Christ.
Did the Wisdom of Solomon share that critique?
It did. The author argues that those who worship idols are foolish and without excuse because God's existence and nature are evident in creation itself. He writes, "All people who were ignorant of God were foolish by nature. From the good things that are seen, they did not succeed in knowing him who is, and from studying the works, did not discern the artisan."
It's like he's saying that creation itself points to the creator, leaving those who choose to worship idols with no defense. It's a pretty bold statement.
It is. And Paul echoes this sentiment in his letter to the Romans, stating that what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. Ever since the creation of the world, his invisible nature, namely his eternal power and deity, has been clearly perceived in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. So both the Wisdom of Solomon and Paul use that argument from creation to challenge idolatry. It's fascinating to see how these ideas were circulating and being debated at the time.
Exactly. And their critique goes even deeper. They both connect idolatry with moral corruption.
That makes sense. If you're worshiping false gods, it's probably going to skew your sense of right and wrong.
Right. The Wisdom of Solomon states that the worship of idols not to be named is the beginning and cause and end of every evil. And Paul makes a similar connection in Romans, arguing that because people exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the creator, God gave them up to various forms of moral depravity.
It's a sobering thought, the idea that turning away from the true God can lead to all sorts of social and personal problems.
And here's where Paul takes that traditional argument and flips it on its head a bit.
How so?
Well, while the Wisdom of Solomon focuses its critique on the Gentiles, Paul applies it to both Jews and Gentiles. He argues that no one is inherently righteous before God. We've all fallen short.
It's like he's saying that no one has a monopoly on righteousness. We're all in need of God's grace, regardless of our background.
Exactly. And that's at the heart of Paul's message. It's the radical inclusivity of the gospel. It transcends all human divisions and offers salvation to everyone who believes.
Okay, so we've talked about Ben Sira and the Wisdom of Solomon. Are there any other apocryphal texts that had a big impact on early Christianity? What about those stories of the Jewish martyrs who refused to renounce their faith even when facing torture? I've always found those accounts so inspiring.
You're talking about 2 and 4 Maccabees.
Yes. Those stories always leave me speechless.
They are powerful. And those accounts had a profound impact on early Christians, especially those who were facing persecution themselves.
I can see why. When you're staring death in the face, those stories of unwavering faith must have been incredibly encouraging.
Absolutely. They provided a model for enduring suffering. Think about the book of Hebrews, for example. The author praises those who were tortured, refusing to accept release so that they might rise again to a better life. That passage seems to be directly referencing the martyrs of 2 Maccabees who chose torture over denying God because they believed in a future resurrection.
Wow, that's a direct link. It shows how those stories were already influencing Christian writers. What about the early church leaders? Did they draw on those stories as well?
Absolutely. Church fathers like Origen and Cyprian used those accounts to encourage their congregations during times of Roman persecution. They saw the Maccabean martyrs as heroes of the faith, urging their people to emulate their courage and commitment to God no matter the cost.
It's amazing to think that stories written centuries earlier could provide so much strength and comfort in those moments of crisis. It really speaks to the timeless power of those narratives. Did those stories have any other lasting impact on the Christian tradition?
They did. Believe it or not, those Jewish martyrs even had a place in the early Christian calendar of saints. They were honored on August 1st. Figures like Augustine defended their inclusion, arguing that they were true martyrs even though they died before Christ, because they died for the one true God. He saw their deaths as foreshadowing the sacrifice of Christ himself.
That's incredible. It shows how early Christians viewed those figures as part of their own spiritual family tree, honoring their shared commitment to God, even across different covenants.
It's a beautiful example of how early Christians drew inspiration from their Jewish roots. They saw the hand of God at work throughout history, paving the way for the coming of Christ.
Okay, before we move on, I want to circle back to the Wisdom of Solomon. We talked about how it critiqued idolatry, but I have a feeling there's more to it than that, right?
You're right. The Wisdom of Solomon also had a profound influence on early Christian thought about Christ, on what we call Christology. Remember that beautiful passage we discussed earlier about wisdom being a breath of the power of God and a pure emanation of the glory of the Almighty?
Yeah, it was like a glimpse into wisdom's divine nature and her close relationship with God.
Well, early Christians saw in those words a foreshadowing of Jesus Christ, the Word made flesh. They used the imagery of wisdom to understand Jesus' existence before he became human, his divine nature, and his role in creation.
That's fascinating. So they saw Jesus as the embodiment of that divine wisdom described in the Wisdom of Solomon.
Exactly. If you look at passages from Colossians and Hebrews, for example, you see them echoing the language of Wisdom of Solomon, describing Jesus as the image and radiance of God. It highlights his eternal existence and his intimate connection with the Father.
It's like they're looking at Jesus through the lens of the Wisdom of Solomon.
That's a great way to put it. And this wasn't just a passing fad. The Wisdom of Solomon played a crucial role in theological discussions for centuries, helping early Christians grapple with those big, complex concepts like the Trinity and the relationship between the Father and the Son.
So it had a real impact on Christian doctrine.
It did. Wow. And it wasn't just the Wisdom of Solomon, just like they did with the Old Testament. early Christians saw those apocryphal texts as containing prophetic hints about the coming of Christ.
Can you give us an example of that? What kind of passages did they point to?
Take Baruch 3.3637, for instance. It speaks of God discovering every way of knowledge and giving her to Jacob, his servant, and to Israel, whom he loved. Afterward, she appeared upon earth and lived among men.
I can see how early Christians would interpret that as a prophecy about Jesus with wisdom, who they identified as Christ coming to earth to dwell among humanity.
Exactly. And there's Wisdom of Solomon too, which describes the wicked plotting to lie in wait for the righteous man. Early Christians saw that as foreshadowing the crucifixion. They found those echoes of Christ throughout the Apocrypha, using them to reinforce their understanding of his person and mission.
It's amazing to think about those early believers searching those texts for clues, for confirmations of what they believed about Jesus.
It shows how they viewed these texts as part of a bigger story, a unified scriptural witness to God's plan of salvation culminating in the coming of Jesus Christ.
You know, it's kind of wild to think about these texts. Most people haven't even heard of them, and yet they had such a huge impact on the early church.
It really is. And what's fascinating is that even though we might have different ideas about what belongs in the Bible today, recognizing how those early Christians used these texts, it helps us understand how Christian thought developed. It's like tracing the roots of the faith we know today.
Yeah, it's like uncovering this hidden layer of history that gives us insights into the beliefs and practices of those first Christians.
Yeah.
From those unexpected parallels to the influence on early Christian theology, and even the inspiration they drew from the martyr stories, the Apocryphal offers such a fascinating glimpse into that whole world.
It does. It's like we've been on this archaeological dig uncovering these ancient artifacts that tell us so much about the people who came before us.
This deep dive has seriously opened my eyes to the importance of the Apocrypha. If these lesser-known texts played such a big part in shaping Christian thought, I mean, what other hidden connections and surprising influences are out there just waiting to be discovered?
That's what's so exciting, right? There's always more to learn, more connections to make, more insights to uncover from the past. It makes you wonder what other treasures are still out there.
I'm definitely feeling inspired to keep exploring these texts. Who knows what other gems we might find?
That's the beauty of it. There's always something new to discover, a new perspective, to consider, a deeper understanding to reach. It's a journey that never really ends.
Well, thanks for being such a fantastic guide on this journey through the Apocrypha. It's been eye-opening, to say the least.
It's been my pleasure. And remember, the adventure doesn't stop here. Keep exploring. Keep asking those tough questions. Keep searching for those connections that help illuminate the past and deepen our understanding of the present.
You got it. Until next time, happy digging.